long list of what Camden's doing. I was actually going to set out the challenge that I think the country and the Labour Party faces, albeit from a Camden perspective. Is anyone really offended by the F word? Okay, housing's fucked. It's absolutely fucked. It's more fucked than it has ever, ever been. And it's really important that you internalise that, because we won't get to a solution until people realise it's completely fucked. The only people housing now works for in this country is baby boomers who have just retired or coming up to retirement, who've got a good final salary pension scheme and as yet do not have any care needs. That's the only group of people it works for. It is too expensive. It is too expensive to buy. It is too expensive to rent. It's even too expensive to buy and rent in the less affluent, less costly areas of the country. And the changes that the Tories are making are only going to make it more expensive to buy and more expensive to rent. We're not building enough. The stock that we do have is still too poor quality in many cases, particularly in the private rented sector. The last Labour government did an amazing job of increasing standards in the social rented sector, and yet a lot of quality in the private rented, a lot of the private rented sector is very, very, very poor quality. It's really important to have a varied housing economy. You have to have ownership and rent and price points suitable to different people across the market, because we want to have a varied economy. It's really important that people on low wages can afford to live in the centre of big cities, because our economy relies on it, never mind our social fabric and our communities. The Tories are going to end all of that and present some really, really significant challenges to Labour local government. When Cameron stands up, as he's done a few times in the last week, and said that the Tories are building more council housing than ever happened under Labour, it's important to remember two things about that. Labour, for the first half of its term, prioritised investing in the poor quality of social housing stock that they inherited from the Tories in 1997. And that the Tories are not building any council housing. Labour-run councils are building council housing, funded from their own assets, because there is no grant from central government to build council housing. So when James and I are building council housing, we are doing it because we've prioritised it politically and are taking really difficult decisions and having debates in our communities about increasing density, increasing heights, putting more of a draw on some of our public services, because the outcome of that is more people living locally. And yes, taking a bit of fire for building some homes to sell, because we need to fund this somehow. So I think we all take some flack for not for the proportions that we have where we're selling them. It's a huge political challenge for Labour that the National Labour Party needs to get to grips with. There are a lot of good examples used across the country, not just London, from local councils about how we can get to grips with this, from work that we're doing to build homes at all price points, work that we're doing to improve standards in the private rented sector, tackle lettings agencies. All of those things are being done by Labour councils around the country. But the political challenge, I think, is a bit bigger than that, and it's worth reflecting on the differences between Tory and Labour at the moment, because it's actually not always been the case that the Tories and Labour have disagreed on housing. The Prime Minister who built the most council housing in the country was actually Macmillan, who continued a programme started under the previous Labour government. So in that period, there was a settlement around what housing should be. At the moment, I fundamentally do not agree with the Tory party on what type of housing should be built, where it should be built, or who it should be built for. And so there is no consensus at a national level, and it's really important that the Labour Party fights what the Tories are doing but comes up with its own narrative. One of the things that this Tory government are really good at is the political con trick. So if you just take one thing in the housing bill, which is colloquially called pay to stay, which is where people on an income over £40,000 living in council housing will have to pay market rent. In Camden, that means they will face an instant £15,000 annual increase in their rent. And I don't know if anyone in this room, whatever your circumstances are, could suddenly find £15,000 and then pay it year in, year out, £40,000 is a relatively small household income, particularly when you think it could be two, three, or even four adults living in the house. But when you talk to people about this policy, they think, well, yeah, of course, people who earn more should pay a bit more for their housing. It actually sounds perfectly reasonable. And so we need to come up with tricks and the political narrative to counter these. And I'll come on to some of how I think we should do that in the question and answers. But we have to fight for the future of housing, because Emma's just told me my time's up.
I look forward to that further exploration. I think Sarah's absolutely right, and you know, we have to be countering the narrative, because it is the narrative that has driven us into what was once a crisis and is now a catastrophe. So I'm going to turn to someone who's not, I have no idea of his own personal politics, but he's here representing the housing world, which is Roger Harding, who's Director of Communications and Policy and Campaigns at Shelter. So what are the campaigns, and how do we get the messages out, not just to us, to the people who turn up on Saturday mornings and talk about housing, but to everybody?
Thanks, Emma. which is what, it's a good teeing up, because that's what I'm going to cover, basically. So I'm not going to tell you more about the problem. Sarah's covered some of that, and of course I've only got 4 minutes. And probably most of you live somewhere near the epicentre of it, which is London, although, as Sarah says, it affects lots of people up and down the country. And it's getting worse, despite the admirable efforts of many local authorities. It's getting worse, and the housing bill is clearly going to make it a whole lot worse. So what I wanted to focus on is how we fix it, learning some lessons from what I've picked up at Shelter in recent years, my 6 years there, but also it's Shelter's 50th in December of this year. We were founded in 1966, and we've been doing a lot of reflections there within Shelter about the good and bad things that have happened over that period, and what we can learn from them, and particularly what we can learn as to our approach. And for me, there are a couple of lessons that I just briefly want to take you through. One is, and this speaks to Sarah's point around building that consensus, one is about uniting people in concern about this and genuinely building solidarity on it. And the second is basically around avoiding what seem to be quick fixes that ultimately don't fix an awful lot. So first up, on uniting and solidarity, I think we should ask ourselves the question, why is housing up the agenda at the moment? It is partly up the agenda because, as Sarah says, it's fucked. But it's not only up the agenda because it's fucked. It was pretty fucked in 2010, and yet it was completely absent from the general election. And equally, need, sadly, isn't a good driver of any issue being up the agenda. If need for action was the driver of most things, climate change would be higher up the agenda, social care would be higher up, and so on and so forth. So the reason is that campaigners like Shelter have spent a lot of time driving up the agenda, and how we've gone about doing that is by uniting more people in concern about this. You don't need to tell a homeless person or a homeless family that we've got a housing crisis. What you do need to do is spend a lot of time telling people who don't fully realise that we have a housing crisis, or they don't realise the full extent of it at the moment. Because if you look across the country, you've got about 1 in 3 households live in a home that is owned outright. Zero mortgage in it. 1 in 3. So a third of the country. Next third owned with a mortgage. And most of those would have, or a good chunk of those, would have paid off all, probably over about 50% of that mortgage. And then of that final third, you've got a lot of people in secure social homes at the moment, who at the moment are actually seeing their rents going down, some of them. So actually, we're not talking about a majority of the country that is personally affected, but we are talking, but we can get to those people and tell them the extent of this problem if we're sort of clever about it. And one of the ways in which we need to do that is speaking to people about their children's futures, particularly, and the next generation, up and down the income scale. You're seeing that more in London because it's more obvious in London, but it needs to be done outside of London. And the more that we've been telling that story and saying it is your problem as well as our problem, and it's everyone's problem, that is why we've seen it go up the agenda. And despite the fact, you know, many of us may not like some of the policies coming out of the government and the housing bill at the moment, they are paying attention to the issue because they know they have to pay attention to the issue because they are seeing it affecting many more electoral groups. So we have to build that solidarity between low and middle earners on this. And crucially, we have to make sure that we don't make this out to be somebody else's problem. So you particularly see this with social housing. A sort of argument goes, we need a lot more social housing, because we need the social housing for the most vulnerable in society. And that is not incorrect, but if you overdo that, you talk about social housing as if it is charity for a small number of people, and a niche issue of people most of us may not even know or meet. The reason we need social housing is because there's an awful lot of boringly normal people on low incomes who just need a bit of a hand. And I would spend as much, if not more, time talking about those people. Because at the moment, in British politics, people on low incomes are being badly served by those on the right and the left. The right talking about people being feckless and strivers and all the rest of it, which is clearly not the case. But sometimes, equally on the left, people talking far too much about people being vulnerable in the way that they are. They're just not, or most people aren't. They're just, as I say, normal and needing a hand. So that's on building solidarity. Very, very quickly on quick fixes. Basically, don't fall into the trap of going, it's simple, we need to do X. It's sadly not simple, and therefore we need more than just throwing a lot of money at this and throwing money at house, council house building programme. That will help, but also we need a lot of reform around the land area. And equally, people will say something along the lines of, it's simple, all we need to do is cap rents. A lot of people want rent capping to work. That is not the same as it actually working, and there's sadly not the evidence that hard rent caps rather than just longer tenancies will actually work. So anyway, avoid the quick fixes, and then, as I say, the most crucial one for me is build solidarity, and that's genuine solidarity, not just standing next to someone, but bringing people together and then judging yourself on the quality of the change that you deliver, not the sort of the virtue of the change that you want. Thank you.
I think the combination of your message about solidarity, but also about, you know, Labour's focus on, over-focus on the vulnerable is really important. I've often had arguments with people both on the right and the left about people like Bob Crowe staying in social housing, obviously the now late Bob Crowe. I hate the argument that Bob Crowe shouldn't have stayed in his social home, because all you're saying to people on council estates is success doesn't live here, and that is the worst message you can send out. Yeah. Sorry, I'm abusing my position as chair to make a point there. Now, I would like to apologise on behalf of the Fabians for the fact that although both of our council speakers are fantastic, they are also from North London. In my day job, I see Labour councils across the country doing amazing work on housing, and I think that we should be investigating and learning from across the country. But I also know that Islington Council is doing some really, really interesting work. So I'd like to welcome Councillor James Murray, who's their Executive Member for Housing and Development. Thank you, James.
Thanks very much, Emma. And I'm going to obviously radically disagree with everything that Sarah said. Housing's fine. We should probably be building slightly fewer homes, actually, at higher price points. No, but seriously, I think, you know, part of the discussion today is how we can lead from opposition. And as Sarah said, it's not the Tory government building council homes, it's councils building council homes. And it's councils like us and other ones across the country. And I'll just give you one example of a scheme that we opened just before Christmas in Islington, which was basically a conversion of some ground floor garages into about 25, 30 new homes. And what we did there is we did a combination of homes for social rent, shared ownership homes, and some homes to buy. And altogether, that scheme washed its face, it all paid for itself. All of the homes were offered to people living in Islington first, whether they were rented or to buy or shared ownership. They were all going to Islington residents before anyone else. None of them were allowed to be sold to buy-to-let landlords. And we were saying, look, every home we're building here is helping someone in Islington. Admittedly, the open sale ones were pretty expensive because it is an expensive area at the end of the day. But we were showing that actually a council can build housing for everyone. You know, talking a bit about the idea that Roger raised about how do we make sure we've got a broad offer and we're not just focusing on one particular tenure for one particular group, we can actually say councils are at the centre of making sure we're building the number of homes we need, but also the right sort of housing. So I think in empowering councils and hopefully in City Hall in May, we can show what's possible. And we can also try and change the debate so that people don't just shrug their shoulders and think actually governments or councils or so on can't do anything about the housing crisis. I'll give you one very quick example of something we did in Islington, which I think really caught people's imagination, which is that some of you will know, if you walk around particularly central London, but actually most of London now, a lot of the new developments are sold off plan overseas, and it really winds people up. It's the one thing more than anything else that winds people up. Now, it's not to say if we sold them all in London or in Britain first, that would end the housing crisis, far from it. But I think it really irks people, the idea that we've got a housing crisis and yet these homes are being sold as international investments. And so we brought in a planning policy in Islington, which started from the deeply radical suggestion that new homes should actually be lived in once they're built. And we've basically got a planning condition now on new homes to say they have to be regularly occupied. And if we feel they're not being regularly occupied, we want evidence that they are being, and we can enforce that condition. And although that's not going to solve the housing crisis, I think it's just an example of what you can show you can do when you've got some power and actually move in a direction where housing is actually for people who want to live and work in the local area. I won't go on about all the Tory housing policy because we could just go on all day about how awful it is that you've now got starter homes, as we've been discussing briefly, for £450,000 in London. I think it's also worth pointing out, just it occurred to me the other day, that technically, if you were a renter under 40 and you won the lottery, you could still buy a starter home. You know, you could buy it with that cash. There's nothing to stop a lottery winner buying a starter home. So the idea that they're well targeted at people in housing need is totally divorced from reality. But I think the important thing that we have to develop over the next couple of years is using what we're doing in councils and in City Hall and other elected institutions around the country to make our plan. And I think central to our plan has to be our narrative. I mean, I could go on about all of the technical things we need. You know, we could probably talk all day about land. You know, once you start mentioning land, we could talk about that a lot. We could talk about bricks. There aren't actually enough bricks at the moment. That's a really big problem. But I'm really not going to talk about that. Maybe that's a pub conversation later. Well, having said that, now no one will come up to me in the pub. Can I get into the conversational black hole about bricks? Yes, discuss it at another appropriate time. But I think the key thing is we need to talk about the narrative about what kind of homes do we need. So when we talk about numbers, yes, we need to know how we're going to build the numbers. We need the 200,000, 250,000, whatever, homes to be built every year. But without seeming, without being overly simplistic, each individual person or household only needs one home. You know, they don't need 200,000. They need to know that within that 200,000, one of them is going to help them. Mm-hmm. So actually talking about what sort of homes we build is absolutely essential to making sure people have confidence in our plans. And I think, you know, what people want is informed by what they need, but also what they think they can get. So if I'm knocking your doors in my ward and I meet a family who are council tenants and overcrowded, what they want is a new council tenancy in a bigger property. You know, in a different situation, maybe they would want somewhere to buy, but in that particular situation, the way that they can solve their needs and they can make life better for their family is to get a council home. If you knock on the door of private renters, what they need and what they want is to buy a home so that they can move on. So we need to make sure, and I'll just wrap up now because I've got the little nod. What we need to make sure is that we have that offer where we're investing in the next generation. As Roger said, I think the one thing that unites people is the next generation. One reason why journalists are writing about housing now is because their kids can't get somewhere to live. And I think we need to make sure that we have that offer for the next generation about investing in affordable homes, both to rent and to buy, to make sure that everyone can have a home of their own.
Thank you, James. Although there was a disappointing lack of swearing. We are recording this, I should warn you. And I'm very much looking forward to being the first ever post on the Fabian Society with an adult content warning. So I'd now like to pass on to our final speaker, who is Luke Murphy. Luke's a former housing advisor to the party on a national level.
Thanks. So I'm just going to concentrate on a few lessons that I learned as kind of housing advisor to the party over the last parliament. I won't repeat what the other panellists have said, that housing obviously is fucked. I didn't think I'd say that on a Fabian platform. I won't go into the problems of the housing crisis really, other than to say that for me I think it is the biggest public policy challenge that we face this decade. And I won't go into all the sort of pernicious Tory policies either. Other than to say, I think you can sum them up by saying that their policies will essentially mean that a few more people will enjoy the benefits and security of home ownership at the expense of almost everyone else and running down other tenures. What I'm going to focus on is the lessons, some of which you've heard already, about how I think Labour should respond. First of all, is to oppose strongly in Parliament, particularly the Housing and Planning Bill, and we've seen John Healey and the Shadow Housing team do that. scrutinising the bill and picking out the main issues with it. But as Roger and others were saying, you have to do that by building a coalition of the usual suspects, and I don't mean that in a disrespect to sort of, charities like Shelter and others. They are absolutely crucial in moulding the debate, but also you've got to partner with businesses, you know, businesses particularly in London, Oxford and some of the other places where particular pressure on housing, they are increasingly recognising the impact that the housing crisis is having on their workers and labour mobility. The front page of the Evening Standard on Thursday or Friday was actually from a report that London First, the business organisation, did. So actually partnering with those organisations can strengthen your message. Second of all, as others have said, focusing on what Labour is actually doing in power all over the country. Labour councillors are doing fantastic work building affordable homes and coming up with innovative ways to build more homes. Obviously that is set and restrained by a national framework set by the Tory government, but within that Labour councils all over the country are doing some really good things, and we must focus on that, not just to kind of advertise what they're doing, but draw on that policy for national policy as well. Crucially, devolution deals are going to see a lot of new powers, housing, investment, planning and land going to predominantly Labour city regions. That is a huge opportunity for us over the next 5 years to show that we can, that Labour can operate in a different way and deliver in a different way. And obviously, as Sadiq has said, the London mayoral campaign is a referendum on housing, and if he gets in, into power in May, obviously that is another great opportunity for us to show what else we can do. But thirdly and finally, the most important thing for me is to set out a compelling alternative about what we would do now and what we would do in power. As others have said, as James was saying, I would avoid statistics and big numbers and targets. They mean very little. We had a lot of debates over the last 5 years about whether we should be commit to building 100,000, 200,000, 250,000. Actually, as James was saying, it's meaningless to most people. You need to focus instead on using language that people understand, associate with their lived experience and how they approach housing. They see it, a home as security, they think of ownership, they think of putting down roofs, and that's the kind of language we need to focus on. We do need to be the party of home ownership. I do think we need to own that. That's still the prism through which most people view housing, but that doesn't mean what doing what the Tories are doing, which is running down affordable housing, or ignoring the fundamental problems, as Roger was saying, such as, you know, we must tackle and come up with policies to tackle the dysfunctional land market. In my view, we should look at the Greenbelt, which is strangling city regions and major towns and forcing up the price of housing because they can't expand. It's also bad for our environment because people have to commute more further into the town because they live on the other side of the Greenbelt. We should look at tax. We have one of the least... the most regressive tax systems in the world, property taxes, taxation systems. I've been told at the time. Two more points, finally, just at the end. Obviously, we must defend housing for those on the lowest incomes, but we must do that as well by increasing support for it. So that means maybe looking at policies around contribution and also a labour route from social housing to home ownership. And finally, it's all very well having some good policies on housing, but more generally, we must restore our economic credibility, because if we're going to, you know, hopefully commit to a programme of spending £2, £3, £4 billion a year on building more social homes, we must have people's trust on the wider economic credibility in order to deliver that.
Thank you very much. I'm going to open it up for questions now. I'm quite interested just to see, first of all, how reflective we as a group are of the housing market, the country as a whole. So could I please see a show of hands if you are a person who owns and has paid their mortgage outright? Blimey. Lucky, lucky sods. Okay, keep your hands up. Now, add to your hands if you are a person who owns but has a mortgage. So that's interesting. I think we're reflective probably of the ownership, but a lot more of you have paid your mortgage than the country, which probably reflects the average age of the Fabian Society.
It's an age.
Okay, so I'm going to take questions in groups of three. I'm going to take the lady at the back first, gentleman at the front here, and then the gentleman there in the grey jacket. So let you first.
So my name's Ellen. I work in housing. I'm the welfare reform and financial inclusion manager for a housing association. And my question is really, how do the panel feel that housing associations will change in the next decade, bearing in mind the more business focus that's likely to, to be more forthcoming by the recent policy?
Okay, and you, sir?
I'm Jeff Beaton from York, and I write quite a lot on housing and the unfairness of it all. I come from North Kent, and the London housing market has been cooled very, very slightly by people moving along the North Kent coast, probably to do with the railway line. Now, Shelter had a project just across the Medway Airstreet from these places to build on the Hoo Peninsula. I had a proposal as well, I'll show you that later. But quite near there, there's All Hallows, which has quite a lot of what they call park homes, or very similar to the old-fashioned prefabs. Now, if you read the Daily Mail, which I bet many of you do, you will know that it's possible to provide shacks that people like living in for about 15 grand. And I just wondered why we don't take those sorts of ideas up and look at good quality prefabs again, on railway lines into London, because the Hoo Peninsula could be half an hour from Canary Wharf, or certainly from St Pancras in York. And why we stop people doing it, because there's an immense pressure to stop people living in these sorts of places, because somebody doesn't like it.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Sandy Martin from Ipswich. Luke, you mentioned taxation very, very briefly. Of course, we did used to have mortgage income tax relief, and I know that that predominantly favoured people who were better off than average, but the fact was that it made a difference between whether you were purchasing your own house or whether you were purchasing the house to let out. And home ownership carried on growing in this country as a proportion of the housing market right up to the moment that we abolished housing income tax relief. It is now, I believe, more financially sensible for somebody to set up a company and then rent their house off the company they've set up than it is to buy it themselves, which seems pretty bonkers to me. So what can we do to restore the level playing field so that it is actually now, again, financially viable and sensible for people to buy their own properties? And do you think some element of mortgage income tax relief needs to be a part of that?
Thank you. Because I'm unimaginative, I'm just going to go down the line in terms of responses. So we'll start at this end with Luke.
Thanks. Just focusing on that tax question, I suppose. I mean, I was predominantly thinking about kind of council tax, which is, you know, hasn't been reformed for 30 years, is largely regressive, promotes under-occupation. It's not necessarily a popular tax to look at and reform. That's why no political party has touched it for 30 years. I think that is definitely something that obviously needs to be looked at. I think you could more efficient use of housing stock is part of the, you know, the way to tackle the housing crisis. In terms of mortgage tax relief, I'm not necessarily sure I would draw a direct correlation between the ending of the relief and the drop off in the home ownership. I think there were probably wider factors. I don't think it was right that actually that relief applied to those who wanted to be a landlord, and because they were still getting that relief up until recently. I think they still are, although this actually, to be fair to this government, they have cut that back. But I think there are more than enough subsidies at the moment going to people that want to buy their own homes through Help to Buy and other subsidies. So actually, I think we need to focus on a wider set of housing policies. On prefabs, I'd say, well, actually, there are really good examples abroad, passive houses, etc., that we would see as prefab here, but actually are quite advanced, very ecologically friendly. And I think that's definitely something we should be looked at. And actually, there are examples of good councils using self-build and custom-build, using that kind of technology. It's much more advanced, much more open to that kind of thing here. And finally, on housing associations, I think in 10, 15 years, they've already changed. Some are more willing to do that, and others, obviously, that they are having to focus on making a profit. In order to cross-subsidise, because of the cutback in investment, in some respects that is inevitable. I do think, you know, by the time we have when we do have the next Labour government, I think what you'll see is you'll have to almost reinvent housing associations, because I'm afraid many of them will be almost like private developers. They have their place. We need more competition in that market, but we still need what housing associations were there to do, which was help and provide housing for those on the lowest incomes.
Watch it.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for allowing me to plug and brag about something that Shelter did a little while ago. So, for those who don't know, there's an economics prize set up by a guy called Lord Wolfson, Tory peer, and he basically gave out created the world's second largest economics prize in cash terms. For those who come up with a proposal for a garden city that didn't cost the taxpayer anything, we came second and got a very nice cheque for £50,000 that we could put towards our services and so on, which is great, and a slightly unusual sort of fundraising strategy for us in the last 12 months. We came up with a proposal to basically build a new garden city on the Hoo Peninsula, which is on the North Kent coast, with very potentially incredibly good commuting lines into London. For various political reasons, we can't progress that, but we are exploring something else, which I can't talk about at the moment, that maybe had to do something similar. But I think that our proposal for that highlighted basically the importance of tackling the land issue in this country, basically, that there are an awful lot of landowners from the classic, sort of very classic, aristocratic landowners all the way through to very modern hedge funds who are earning an awful lot of unearned gains, basically, that society should be benefiting from more and claiming more of to build affordable housing and to build infrastructure as well. That could be done through the tax system, but I think it is more likely that it could be done through basically giving local authorities, city regions and others greater control to step in and negotiate far more aggressively with those landowners to get it at a cheaper rate, with the threat of improved compulsory purchase if those landowners don't want to play ball on that. It's something that governments of various parties did incredibly well after the Second World War. It's something the local authorities did an awful lot after the Second World War. We still use it to this day across different parties. It's what built Canary Wharf. It's how we got the Olympics up and running, and there are other examples going on at the moment. And we need to just get back in the habit of doing that across various parties. So I think that's what that prize basically highlighted. And if you do that, you don't actually have to go down this route of building smaller and smaller prefab units, because you do get sort of, I understand these, where people come from on this, of you can get sort of ideas of perhaps we should knock up a load of shipping containers or whatever it may be to get houses really, really cheaply. We don't need to if we tackle the land problem.
But why stop people? And what about the embodied carbon? Building an ordinary house is 100 tonnes of embodied carbon. That's our budget for heating 2 degrees if we spread it amongst the world.
I don't know about embodied carbon, but we can perhaps pick that up in the pub alongside bricks.
good pub chat.
to give an example, basically, we have been building smaller and smaller and smaller housing units as a country. We now build the smallest in Europe, and they have not got cheaper. In fact, they've got more expensive. Yeah. So building smaller and cheaper stuff isn't the problem. The building costs aren't rocketing. It's the land costs that are rocketing. And
the planning permission costs.
And that's what we need to deal with. On very quickly then, on the other two points, very, very quickly. On tax, I think it's less, I agree with Luke basically, that it's less about giving buyers more an incentive. I think the government, to its credit on this, is right to focus on dampening down demand in other areas and dampening down demand for buy-to-let landlords, and it'll be very interesting to see how those changes play out, and I very much doubt that we'll get the kind of Armageddon that some landlord bodies have been suggesting that we'll see when they kick in April. And then on housing associations, I think it's, again to Luke's point as well, I think it is a crucial period for housing associations, and they've all got to ask themselves some very big questions as to what they are there for and what their mission is in the 21st century. On the plus side for them, they've got an awful lot of freedom to do that. There is no grant of any great note for them, so they're not sort of confined to a certain model of working set by national government now, so they are very free to do what they want. And I think it'll be very interesting to see which way some of them go.
I used to work for the National Housing Federation, which, for those of you who don't know, is sort of the trade body for housing associations. And I think Luke and Roger are absolutely right. And it breaks my heart, actually, to see the drift away from social purpose of housing associations. And I think we, as housing campaigners, as people who care about housing, need to care about the future of that sector, because it is being both pushed and pulled away from social purpose and away from what it was set up to achieve. James.
Thanks. Yeah, I'll be careful not to repeat points which have been made already. I'll just talk very briefly about land, because I'm really glad we are talking about that, because I think it is such a crucial part of the debate. And I'll give you one example of a recent case of a planning permission in Islington, which I think this is all in public domain, so I can tell you the figures, which is a good thing, because it really shows how fucked land is. I got my swear word in. I've been trying to work out how to get that in since Emma commented earlier. So there was a site in Islington which was owned by the Ministry of Defence. It was a Territorial Army site, and the current value of that land for its current use is probably about £1 million or just less than that. The MOD wanted to sell it off, and we did a bit of initial research as a council to work out what would be a sort of viable scheme to put on that site. And we worked out that you could give the MOD about £5 million for that site and still build lots of homes, of which 50% would be genuinely affordable housing. So that would be quite a good scheme. You'd get 50% affordable housing, the MOD would get quite a big windfall, it would be all kind of win-win all round. What ended up happening was that the people who bought the site bought it for £13 million. And they came back to us and said, oh, because we paid so much for the land, we can only offer you 14% affordable housing. There's a long planning battle which then ensued. But I think that example just shows so straightforwardly how if you pay more for the land, you can't build the affordable housing. And that's what's happening time and time again, where developers pay or buy an option on a piece of land for a price, assuming they will get away with not much affordable housing at the end of the day. And then when they come to us, they can't provide the affordable housing because they've overpaid for the land, or so they say. Yeah. So it's a very circular argument when we're talking about land. And I think we need to have some solutions to that. I think the one other point about land, which is probably too detailed to go into in depth now, but it's about capturing some of the value uplift, particularly from transport improvements. You know, so if we are building Crossrail 2 in London, for instance, you know, around those stations, you're going to have massive, massive uplift. You probably already have got a huge amount of uplift there because people are expecting Crossrail 2 to come forward. You know, why aren't we making sure that we are using some land acquisition powers to capture some of that uplift and to make sure we're putting it into infrastructure and affordable homes rather than just making some landowners very well off? And I think that is also, I won't get into the Greenbelt debate in too much detail, but it's one issue about anything you do with the Greenbelt. As soon as you say you're going to build on that piece of land, you've got to be careful that it doesn't just make whoever owns that piece of greenbelt very, very rich, if the land value is just allowed to go up very rapidly. And just finally on housing associations, I mean, I think if you want to characterise the last few years in housing associations, it's been about a divergence in the sector, because they have been given more freedom, they have been allowed to go in slightly different directions, and they are separating themselves out. And you know, I will say that some of them are better than others. You know, there are some who are kind of keeping their rents down, who are keen to maintain a social purpose, and there are others who definitely are not, and you know, really find it quite difficult sometimes to work with them. And I think as councils, we have quite a difficult relationship. You know, when I met some representatives from the National Housing Federation, where Emma used to work at, we met up, and the first thing I said is, I was like, look, let me just get this off my chest. And I had a real go at them, and I was like, you know, you signing up this right to buy deal, selling us down the river, Right, done that. Now let's talk about what we do next, because they are there, and they are going to have money from this right to buy. And actually, from my point of view, this is not a long-term strategy, but in the next few years, we need to make sure that right to buy money is reinvested in our local areas, providing new homes for social rent, because it's going to be quite hard for us to get money for social rent from government, obviously. But if we can work with housing associations to do that, and that is a good thing. So we need to find those housing associations who share our vision and make sure they do actually build these homes for social rent, because I think that's the reaction we're going to have in the next few years.
Thank you, James. And Sarah?
I think, Jeff, on your point, the issue there is quality. You used the word shacks. There are some very, very high-quality prefab builds out there, but I am not in favour of any policy that results in us throwing up low-quality, small homes that make people live in in awful circumstances. We already have enough of that. I do think we can do more with prefab. I think there are products out there where you can build high quality homes a bit more quickly, and it's very, very commonly used in Scandinavia and Germany, and we need to be looking at that, but it has to be about quality. Reintroducing more than income tax relief is probably the last way I would change the housing tax system, to be honest. I think there are so many more fundamental problems before you get to that, and there are huge. This government's introduced a huge number of incentives to home ownership. Actually, some of which don't really touch the sides. You know, the £3,000 that you get off a homeowner ISA just doesn't help anywhere in the southeast at all in terms of saving up a deposit. It's meaningless. But actually, there's a huge way that you could transfer. You know, again, we could have a pub conversation about land and housing taxes if you want to do it. We're going to be having a lot of fun in the pub later. housing associations, Ellen, I don't know which one you work for. I am still very, very angry at the G15 selling us down the river on the housing association right to buy. I fundamentally believe there is simply no way the Tories would have got that through the Houses of Parliament. It would have needed changes to charity law. There are they don't have a majority in the House of Lords. And despite the protestations of some of the members of the G15 that they won't sign up to it if it results in councils being forced to sell off their high-value voids, I haven't seen anyone pulling out of the voluntary agreement. Now that's on the face of the bill. And I have it in writing from several of the G15 members that that is what they would do. And we could have presented a united front on that, and I think we could have won at least part of that argument. That doesn't mean I don't think the Tories then wouldn't have come back and found another way to force us to sell off high-value voids. They simply want to run down the amount of social housing stock in the country, which is why they wanted to do it that way. That said, as James said, we do need to move forward. We do need to continue to find a way to work together, and there are some good housing associations sticking to their original purpose, doing some good things in London. At the other end of the scale, there are some awful housing associations behaving like the worst private sector rapacious landlords, and I want to work with housing associations that have a social purpose. I think probably, looking forward over the next 10 years, housing associations will move even more towards the intermediate market. And actually, we have a massive challenge in the intermediate market. We have a massive challenge for young professionals and public sector workers and what have you, being able to afford to live in the centre of our cities. And there's a real role for that if housing associations want to grasp it.
Lovely. OK, I'm going to take another round of questions. Can I ask you to be very snappy? Because I'd like to do another two rounds, so I'll say the same to the panellists. Lady with the pashmina there, chap in the grey jumper. I'll take four. Lady there and this guy at the front.
Thank you.
So, lady, you first.
Okay, hi. My name's Frieda. My question, just briefly, I work for Citizens Advice and I've worked in Islington in York Bureau, so I see firsthand the devastation to families that have moved out of borough, and more particularly, the effects on children of the short fixed term tenancies and all that sort of stuff across London, yeah? My question, I'm also a secure tenant, fortunately, for Kensington and Chelsea, which has the highest highest secure rent in the country, which for my secure tenancy is probably £195, which is not affordable for a lot of people. Also, I'm a bit worried about the housing bill, because although I'm an old secure tenant, with the housing bill, things like my right to exchange, if I exchange, I'll only be then given a 2-year fixed term tenancy with anyone that I swap with, all of those sort of issues. So my question is, are we seeing the death of the secure tenancy, not affordable, but the secure tenancy? Are we seeing the death of the secure tenancy?
Thank you. Chat there.
Luke mentioned the...
tell us who you are first.
Sorry?
Tell us who you are first.
Oh, sorry. Dan Wilson-Craw. I'm from the campaign Generation Rent. Luke mentioned the need to be seen as the party of home ownership. It's always annoying when the Tories come out with a line of Labour's anti-home ownership. What's interesting is that they're actually on course to break one of their manifesto promises, which is to build homes exclusively for first-time buyers, because there's a lot of things wrong with starter homes, but even if they were affordable, they would be lost to the open market after 5 years, right, and be sold at a much higher price. So that's one chink in the Tories' facade that the Labour could exploit.
Thank you very much. Lady there.
Natalie Hartley, I'm a junior doctor from Wiltshire, and my question is very simple, really. You talked a lot about building and about sort of constraints of the Greenbelt, but my understanding is there's a million empty homes in Britain, and what about regenerating them?
Lovely, thank you. And the chap at the front.
Yeah, I'm Robert Park. I come from southwest Surrey, borough of Waverley, where, as in London, we've got a rather high proportion of council houses to housing association stock. My question is sparked by an article that was Inside Housing recently about the pooling and redistribution of the receipts from the sale of council stock. But whereas in London, a lot of council houses, so the amount of money that could be raised by the government forcing them to sell them quite high, northwest of England, very, very small numbers, most of it is housing association. So a lot of people are thinking, well, the answer is pool it, redistribute it around the country, which I know Boris Johnson, for one, is fiercely opposed to. I'm wondering which way Labour should go on this.
Okay, thank you. And my imaginative way, I'm going to go back down the line.
I will be as snappy as I can be. Theresa, I think the Tories want to see the end of the secure of the secure tenancy, and I think we have to fight it. As Luke said at the beginning, we have to fight it in the context of housing for all, not just about social tenants and what our view of social tenants is. And we should be fighting for more secure tenancies in the private sector. And that's one of the ways to build a coalition. I think I'm interested in the Greenbelt. I mean, some of the Greenbelt around London in particular is not very green. You wouldn't recognise, you know, it's not fields with lambs lolloping through it and buttercups on the, you know, it's a lot of it's light industrial land. But I'm always staggered, and I check this figure from time to time, and the last time I checked it was just before Christmas. If London was as densely populated as Paris, 30 million people would live here. Now, you don't wander around Paris thinking, my God, this is a horrible overcrowded city, everyone's living on top of each other. It has very well-designed housing and good public open spaces and what have you. There is a lot of space to build by doing things a bit more imaginatively without going further and further into the fields. It might mean we need to tolerate some heights and what have you. You know, the standard in Paris is 8 to 10 storey mansion blocks. And we should think about doing those things. I'm not an anti-Greenbelt builder if it can be defended, but actually I just don't think we need to do it. Actually, there is a lot of opportunity. Robert, of course, pooling the budgets is what they intend to do. They can't afford the housing association right to buy without London's high value void receipts, and that money will run out. Anything that Zach claims he's getting is a commitment on that is utter rubbish. The numbers don't stack up. There are authorities all across the north of England that don't have any high value properties. Okay. They literally don't have any. I think I'm a local council leader. You would expect me to make a strong devolution argument. I think a lot of housing problems are best solved by local councils with their local communities, because we can get purchase and consent for schemes in a way that if they were imposed from Whitehall, you simply won't get them, because we can explain, you know, we're of that community, we can speak to people about what it means, what the changes mean for people's community, and I think there should be much more devolution on housing, and that's one way to solve the crisis.
James.
Great, thanks. To address Theresa's point first, firstly, great to hear you're working at the Citizens Advice Bureau in Islington. Thank you for your work. In terms of secure tenancies, the when I was speaking earlier about opening these new homes just before Christmas, that was on the Friday, and the day before was when the Tories brought in this last-minute amendment to scrap secure tenancies. And you know, there is even just a basic democratic argument in that the way they have been doing this whole bill has been deeply undemocratic, putting in huge and, you know, really kind of tectonic plate shifting amendments at the last minute. You know, they did the report stage, one of the last bits in the House of Commons, at 3 a.m. in the morning, you know, trying to get this all through. And as you say, it is a really profound change, you know, to move towards 2-year tenancies. So you've got families facing potentially facing eviction every 2 years. is really kind of going to completely change the way that we feel about social housing. I think that it's worth us waiting and seeing what discretion councils will have about renewing the tenancies, yeah. And that's sort of what I'm waiting to see in the detail, because we could have a system where, you know, we want to make sure that we can renew as often as possible so that we give people that kind of security. But I think that's probably a discussion for later down the line when all the detail comes out. Dan, I mean, the point generally about generation rent, I mean, I think that, you know, we touched very briefly on some of the idea about limiting rent increases and more secure tenancies and so on during the comments earlier. And I think we do need to have a clear, strong policy on that, because although ultimately building more homes to rent and buy is the right answer, I don't think we can just turn around to generation rent, if you call it that, to say you just have to wait and, you know, you just have to put up with really insecure tenancies and rents that are going up and up with no limits at all, and say to them, you're just going to have to wait until the homes get built to solve that. I think we do need something to say to people, in the meanwhile, we will make life more, more tolerable for you. I mean, I think the only danger with the language is we don't want to imply that generation rent is a good description of the problem, but it's quite a negative thing in a way, because you're saying to people, you are generation rent, you're going to be stuck renting for your whole life or for a very long time. So we need to be careful that we're offering solutions to it as well in a way that people understand it. You know, so rather than just saying, if we just talk about generation rent, I think we're actually almost accepting that people are going to be renting for a generation. And unless we have a better renting offer, then that's not a very attractive kind of thing to say to people. So I think we need to make sure that we have that in the Labour Party and beyond, that we have a clear answers to how to make renting more tolerable in the meanwhile, whilst also saying we're going to build affordable homes for you to buy and we'll secure tenancies and so on. Natalie's point about empty homes, I mean, empty homes is your basic kind of bread and butter. You need to have a strategy to make sure homes aren't being left empty, whether they're new ones, like I was mentioning in terms of the planning policy we've got in my borough, or taking action against dilapidated buildings which are empty. The only caution I would say, though, is that we must be really careful that the empty homes argument doesn't become an anti-building argument. Yeah. Because quite often, you know, I get questions in the council or planning committees and so on. You know, why are you building all these homes when there are empty homes? And like, it's not either or. I'm not suggesting at all that you are saying that, but I'm just saying that we as a party in the movement need to be careful in public that empty homes are not the answer to the housing crisis. It is a part of this very complicated puzzle to fix, but we mustn't let people use it as an argument to be anti-development. You know, we still need to be very pro-growth, very pro-building new homes. And then finally, the point about redistribution, you know, Sarah and I from Inner London Boroughs, we are going to be completely screwed by all of this redistribution, because the money from our council homes is going to fund the Right to Buy nationally, and anything the Tories have proposed about building new affordable homes in London means homes are up to £500,000, usually in outer London rather than in the boroughs where we represent. And I think, you know, we need to make this really strong case, and I will be very parochial for a second, and just say London works socially and economically because it has a mix of housing right across the capital. Yeah. Businesses think that, politicians think that, Londoners think that, and we need to defend it.
So firstly, Natalie, on empty homes, I think there's about 700,000 empty homes up and down the country, and at least half of those are empty just temporarily. There'll be someone sadly passed away or some other reason why it's empty. So there's only about 300,000 at any given point. And basically a lot of them tend to be in areas where they're empty because there's just not jobs in those areas, basically, there once were and there's now not. And that's more of an issue of regeneration, which does need to factor into this debate. But as James says, it shouldn't distract from the overall need to build, because we won't get around it without building, basically. Teresa, on tenancies, I mean, sadly, it does seem to be potentially the end for secure tenancies in social housing, although Shelter and plenty of others will do their best during the course of the housing bill to stop that being the case, or at least giving local authorities some discretion on that. I mean, I can see where the Conservatives are coming from. They have always had a very strong push on home ownership, and there's an honesty to that, and an intellectual coherence to that even. But even if you believe some of these products will work for those on lower incomes, they're not going to work anytime soon. And therefore, before any of that has happened, to strip away secure tenancies in the social sector, to my mind, just seems mean, basically. And And equally, particularly at a time where there is no security in the private rented sector as well. My only hope and silver lining from that is that we can build more unity and solidarity between private renters and social renters, because it is notable that there isn't a big outpouring of public concern about the removal of secure tenancies in the social sector, which is telling about how the brand of social housing has been allowed to sort of drift and become divorced from other people. So hopefully one silver lining, as I say, is that we can build that solidarity. And then finally, Dan, to your point around home ownership more generally, I mean, I think this is one thing that doesn't get mentioned that often, but when it does, I know that it concerns and hurts the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, which is that the last government and this government are the first Conservative-led governments since the Second World War, if not probably since the First World War, that have seen a sustained drop in home ownership. It's just unheard of for 100 years, and that was a very notable and sustained drop. It will almost certainly drop during the course of this Parliament, unless the right-to-buy numbers in housing associations are astronomical very quickly. And I think that bears repeating, because if their focus is to be on home ownership, then by their own measure, they are indeed failing at the moment. And it's an interesting and worthy argument for social housing as well, because one of the best routes into home ownership is through social housing, interestingly. And home ownership was starting to stall in terms of its growth in the early 80s until the right to buy came along, and we saw it propel up one further move again alongside financial deregulation. So I think that just bears repeating publicly a lot, because I know it's something that the Conservative government particularly is very worried about.
Thanks. I won't repeat everything that's been said. I mean, Natalie, on empty homes, I mean, I think I agree with you need a strategy to tackle it, and it is an issue, particularly in some areas, but I wouldn't overstate the issue. With the housing, as James was saying, you know, there's no silver bullet to tackle the housing crisis. You need to tackle empty homes, you need to build more, that means high density, that means tackling the land market, and as I've said, potentially looking at the Greenbelt, sensible reform. Theresa, you about short-term tenancies. I think I won't add to what's been said, but I think we shouldn't refrain from pointing out that the Tories talk a lot about family, they talk about security, they talk about stability, and yet consistently undermine people's stability, security, and their family by taking away their security in all forms. You know, they refuse to give longer-term tenancies to a growing number of people living in the private rented sector, and they're taking them away from people in the social rented sector. That should be a big part of Labour's offer, but also a big part of our attack on the Tories as well. Down on starter homes, I mean, it was a crap policy when they announced it. When they first announced it, they said it would require no government funding, it was going to be great for, you know, for first-time buyers, etc. Then it turned out it was going to require billions of pounds of government investment, that it was actually going to push out other affordable homes, and they were going to give all this money to developers to build homes to buy, which they probably would have built anyway. So, I agree. It's great presentation. I think we do have to learn from the Tories in terms of how they present policies. The difference with Labour, as ever, is that we should be better at presentation, but still have that fundamental substance and policy underneath. And I think that's where we can be. We can really take advantage. On the for sale issue, I think that's a huge a difficulty for councils, particularly in London. Ideally, it wouldn't be happening. But I think obviously we have to fight to ensure that where possible, as many councils can replace the homes lost in each of their areas, however that means the money is distributed.
Thank you. I'm afraid we only have a few minutes left, and this is my 15th Fabian's conference, and I know how important the lunch hour is, so I'm going to be very strict. On my notes it says I'm supposed to give you a minute each at the end, but actually I'm going to try and keep you very, very strict. So what I'd like is one idea each. We've talked a lot about what the problems are. We've talked a little about what the solutions are. So if I could ask each of you for the one key thing that Labour should be doing, both now in opposition and hopefully in government in 2020. And I will start with you, Roger. no pressure.
Exactly. So I'll therefore cheat and just repeat one thing I've said already, which is just that importance of making this everyone's problem, making it a national problem, not some people's problem, and not something that needs charity, as weird as it is for me to say that, but needs a full-blown political response, and therefore to look for policy solutions that speak to a broad range of the public rather than ones that just speak to certain sections of it.
James.
I'll say an obvious self-interested one, which is to get councils building, because I think that councils should be building, as I said, homes to rent, shared ownership, intermediate homes, and homes to buy. Councils, we need councils to have a role just to get the numbers up to a decent level, and to make sure we've got the right sort of homes. We've never built the number of homes we need in Britain when there's been only private sector. You have to have private sector and public sector side by side, both building homes, and both building homes to rent and to buy, and I think that's what we need.
Thank you. Luke?
I'm going to cheat even more than Roger and just agree with what Roger said. build a broad-based coalition of interests. Someone said earlier that I remember what one of the things I remember from the last Parliament was talking to a journalist. I said, why are you, from one of the probably more right-wing papers, said, why are you suddenly interested in housing stories? They said, well, it's because the editor has realised that their kids can't get on the housing ladder. Yeah. So if we speak to that broad group of people, we'll be far more successful.
And finally, Sarah.
I'm going to go for a slightly technocratic one, which picks up on something James said earlier, and we can deliver if we win the mayoralty in May, which is effectively end viability assessments. And what they are the things that push up the land values, which James gave the example of the MOD land. And instead of it, have a housing policy that says we want 30% affordable or 50% affordable or whatever the percentage is. And if developers know that you have to deliver that amount of affordable housing, it keeps the land value price home down. They have certainty, and Sadiq can amend the London plan to make that happen. And we can demonstrate it can happen, and that the London housing market can function in that environment. And then we're leading from opposition and changing the dynamics of housing supply in London.
Thank you very much. Thank you to everybody. I'm sorry I couldn't take all your questions, and I really admire the passion that you have for housing. Do please stay involved. Do get involved with Labour Housing Group or London Labour Housing Group if you are a London resident. Do stay involved in the Fabians. We'll keep having these conversations. They'll be fucking good. Got one in there.
The sweariest fringe event I've ever been to.
And do please go and take your lunch hour. You'll need it. There's a great conference to come.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Helen Coombe.
Yeah. Hi, Helen.
Your counterpart in Redbridge.
Oh, great. Cool.
So I'm coming to your meeting.
Another member of NLGN.
You're having this meeting.
Yeah, on the 29th.
Yeah, they're really interesting.
Yeah, it's a good opportunity to get all of us councils having a protocol about all that viability stuff.
Oh, I did. You're right. I'm very sorry. Because I've got my Labour Housing Group head on.
Mr. Tony, in the first Cabinet meeting in 1997, was asked to put housing as priority.
I know.
And, you know, it followed from there. I was the one member on Surrey Heath Council when Surrey Heath stunned the whole process. Selling them all.